This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. This is episode 143 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, how are we?
Very good, David. I understand you're getting ready for an exciting trip coming up.
I am. Like, you went away 2 weekends ago. I'm going down to Langley Air Force Base for their 100th anniversary air show, and because we are friends with NASA, I'm going to be spending Friday at the NASA side at NASA Langley Research Center, bringing back lots of interviews. We'll be talking about their sense and avoid technology, as well as autonomy and robotics. I'll be bringing back those interviews. Looking forward to talking UAVs down at an Air Force base, and then I'll also get some other stuff now that NASA's gotten discovered X planes again. We'll be bringing back some other interviews for that other show, Airplane Geeks. So I'm really excited, a bit nervous. I'm actually going to be dealing with rocket scientists. So,
well, I think you can hold your own, David.
I've been brushing up on my supersonic transports and sense and avoid technology, so I can sound like I know what the hell I'm talking about. So that's good news. But we got a lot to talk about. Actually, we don't have a lot to talk about. This is going to be a continuation of our last episode, episode 142 with Mike Daniels. And he was at the Drone Dealer Expo. Well, we also, unbeknownst to me, we also had a reporter on the scene. Our listeners know, a regular contributor, Tim Trott. Max sent him on down there and didn't tell me, and
I forgot.
And Tim brought back lots of stuff to talk about.
He did. Tim was our roving reporter at the event. Tim, of course, is from Southern Helicam. He's also the author of several books, including The Droner's Guide and UAS Operations, a Study Guide. Tim spoke with many of the exhibitors and recorded interviews, and we're going to be bringing those to you a little bit in the future. This episode, however, we're going to feature Tim's conversation with Jonathan Ruprecht from RuprechtLaw.com, the drone lawyer, our friend Jonathan. Looking forward to that. Jonathan actually had some very interesting observations and things to say about the state of the drone industry, the state of the organizations that represent us or seek to represent all of us in the drone industry. He also talks about some future regulations that are coming along and a few other very interesting topics. So I think with that, we'll turn it over to Tim and Jonathan with their conversation already underway. Here it is.
Oh, yeah. It'll eventually get more and more strict as time goes on. You can see that if the FAA considers that these are aircraft, therefore all the federal aviation regulations apply, then it's going to get more strict, just like aviation is strict. You can see the trajectory and how it's going to go with the licensing of the pilots. At some point, there'll be discussion regarding the certification of aircraft. They've already brought up that conversation with the micro rule and the four different categories, so you can get closer to people or even operate over people. So you just see it, the trajectory it's going. It will get more regulated. The question is when will those events happen? That's kind of the issue there. Where and so the two factors, I guess, that would catalyze it more and more would be one, it was some type of terrorist activity, something like that, or two, some type of scare based upon a drone hitting an airline or getting really, really close or something like that. Then that will cause a knee-jerk reaction to where people will quickly, more heavily regulate it. And then it's not going to be based upon actual rational thought. It's going to be based way more on fear to ground the whole industry, because the industry is not as much of a necessity as manned aviation is, where people need to travel, cargo needs to travel. But with drones, it's like, well, you could do a lot of this stuff operating on the ground, or not even at all, or have a manned airplane use it if you really need to. So I see it just getting stomped real quick and then getting more tightly regulated as time goes on.
So more regulation future, right?
Yeah, I see more regulation, a lot more
even
regulation.
Even state level.
Public
level.
The states and the towns and the counties are all meddling around in the area. They have no authority to do such. But then they're going to have to actually, someone's going to have to fight that out in the court. But that's going to cost an arrow, and people don't want to pay for that. And it's, so that's what it boils down to. I mean, Florida, how many different, I've been alerted to, I don't know how many town councils trying to pass a drone registration, blah, blah, blah thing. And it just gets, frustrating to try to keep up with it, So at some point, the industry will have to get together to realize that they need to have an industry trade group that'll fight for them and represent them much more so. I mean, at the moment, AMA has been, trying to, I guess, support its constituents in some capacity, AUVSI as well. But then I think the communities are starting to get frustrated and saying, hey, like, we need a little bit more aggressive and prosecution. Like, if you look at the manned aviation side of things, like with ALPA or AOPA, they don't take it from the FAA. They'll just pop them right in the face and let's sue you, buddy. We're going to battle in the court over this. While with the drone sector, it seems to be much more like, let's collaborate with the FAA and deal with that. And so they don't want to rock the boat. While in manned aviation, they realize, like, you just rock the boat. Like, you can't really collaborate with the FAA that much, and they're just going to goof you over at the end of the day. You're not going to represent your constituents fully by just capitulating to everything the FAA says. So
really don't have the power.
Yeah, they don't have the power. There's not enough manpower. There's not, and then the industry is so fragmented with so many people jockeying for first place that it's diffused across different organizations. So you have AUVSI, AMA, UAVSA, the UA, what's the other one? There's this
RCAPA.
Other.
RCAPA.
Yeah, oh yeah, RCAPA. Then there's another one, PAPA or something.
PAPA is the pilots.
Yeah,
I wrote a test for them.
Then there's, I see it. So then there's that one. Then there's another one, UA something. The guy's out of Georgia or something. And so you have all these different industry things that are all jockeying for it. And then you have also, small UAV Coalition, Drone Manufacturers Coalition, the Drone Coalition. And it's like, okay, wow, there's so many things. Like, who's going to do what? And it's they need to actually get together and have one to two groups and just be the end of it. Maybe people don't get along, but at least you can get somewhere, as opposed to spreading thinly the scarce resources we already have.
Case in point was the ARC members.
Yeah.
Did I say it wrong?
Yeah. Well, that's because I've never heard it called an ARC. It's the Aviation Rule Committee.
Yes.
It's like an ARC or an ARAC are the two that are used. So they use that, and then there were some people that got on it, but then there were a lot of people that did not get on it. So then people were wondering, wow, how in the world do you get on it? Because it's invite only, and so that's kind of problematic, because then FAA's saying, this is kind of like Democratic, we'll get our stakeholder analysis, but it's like, but you elected all the stakeholders, so appointing them, so it's not really that stakeholder-ish, because I think there was a lot of people that were left out, and there was a lot of people on there that had very little, it seemed like, aviation experience.
Yeah.
So why in the world were they talking about this? It just seemed to be, it gave the appearance, I guess, of stakeholder analysis, but when pressed further, I don't think it really was.
Getting back to a point that you had a little while ago, does the industry have the type of trade organization that it really needs?
Well, I mean, AUVSI has tried to do it. They've tried to do it. They have done no lawsuits against the FAA. I've never seen anybody do anything. AMA did at one point try to pick a fight back in 2014 with Brendan Schulman and a few others. They have since not continued that fight, and they didn't pick up the fight in the late 2015 with the registration of our regulations, and they have not continued to even do anything in that area. So there is kind of a lot of stumbling and a lack of consensus, because people, I guess, it also goes back to the leadership of these organizations. They don't really fully understand what their constituents want, so they're kind of stuck between so many of their constituents will hate their decision going yes, and so many will hate if they go no. So they are confused of really what to do. They're trying to kind of keep their membership base and without it disappearing. And so there's a lot of that going on. And there's not a real clear direction and scope of this is what we do, this is all we do, like AOPA would or ALPA would. It just seems to be we are the industry trade group representing everybody all the time, everywhere, for everything. And okay, it just seems a little too broad to actually get, you know, to have any effect, because you're going to tick somebody off when you actually do anything.
And at the same time, it's got to be somebody AUVSI or somebody else to have the stature, because any Johnny Come Lately, little R Kappa or something like that, is just not going to have the impact.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, R Kappa with Patrick Egan and those guys. Then the FAA somewhat doesn't like them based upon the FAA kind of pointing, I mean, Patrick Egan pointing out the FAA's shortcomings and failures.
Seems to be his favorite hobby.
Right, well, yeah, and so then that causes some problems there. So, yeah, if you do speak out negatively on the FAA, it somewhat appears that you might not get on stuff, and if you do not have a massive membership base, you might not get asked to be on there. So then once again, you might have to kind of be this guy that just grabs as many constituents as possible, but then represents them very poorly, because you're very just indifferent. You don't really take a stance on anything. Well, we're just going to think about this, and we're going to be safe, and blah, blah. But there's never really, like, actual boots on the ground. Like, actually apply that out. Just apply it out. Like, and so that's a yes, or is that a no, or is that, you know, and so let's do something. Is anyone putting together a fund to try to stop all these towns, counties, cities from doing stuff? AUVSI is doing some stuff here and there, but a lot of it seems to be much more on a grassroots level, and then they reach out to the guys in D.C. to stop that. AMA, I haven't seen too much from them regarding that as compared to the AUVSI guys, with the local chapters being very, very involved at the state, town, county level in trying to stop legislation. But then there's not really any lawsuits to actually get, like, a scalp, if you will. You know, you kind of need to, like, take someone to task, scalp them, and then go, look what we did. Look, this is what we'll do to you. Knock it off. But nobody's really doing that. You know, everyone wants to kumbaya, you know, together and be friendly. And
they're worried about making enemies.
Right. No one wants to make enemies, but you're going to eventually realize that you have no enemies, and you have also no friends. You have no constituents, because they left to go to someone else who could properly, who they believe it will actually represent them and actually carry the fight and protecting their interests.
What are the responsibilities of manufacturers, retailers, and so on with regard to safety and proficiency?
Well, I mean, you would have, well, that brings up a whole interesting products liability type of issue. And then selling it, are you going to be just, you know, selling it to resellers who would be doing the training? And what's their liability there? Because a lot of these people have very little aviation experience, so then they can set themselves up for potential negligent flight instructing type of lawsuits and stuff like that. So then you have that issue, and products hurting somebody, and, you know, rinky-dinky little manuals that are, because they think they're toys, and so they don't actually build them according to how a manned aviation would have a pretty beefy pilot's operating handbook, you know.
Who reads manuals anyway?
Well, exactly. I mean,
pilots do.
Yeah, well, pilots do, but then the culture, it's more of a hobby shop kind of culture, not really airman culture. So it's more bro, less pro, you know, more college, high schooler party kind of vibe, less professional. Like, how often do you see suits, business ties, and stuff at drone conventions? You rarely do. However, you go to manned aviation, corporate flight departments, and stuff like that, everybody's wearing suit and ties. It's a completely different culture. And there's also a lot of that going on playing into the background here, of how people view aviation, how they're properly positioning themselves currently and for the future. But there are some serious issues with manufacturers and resellers, and they definitely would want to contact a product liability attorney or business attorney to properly shield themselves from liability that could come from operating a business as such.
You gave a talk, I believe it was yesterday. What was the prime focus of that talk?
That focus was primarily on the future of the future regulations that will be coming down the pike here with the FAA. So you have the micro-rural recommendations that came out. You have the FAA authorization that's going to be getting discussed more heavily here in July. You have Part 107, which will be coming out most likely 6 months to 3 years from now. And then you have the creation Part 48 registration setup that has already come out, but it's currently being sued. So those are the four things that everyone's kind of like looking at right now. And those are all going to play into how everything goes forward. So the John Taylor case is going to directly affect 107 and the micro rule and how they came out. That also might affect how the FAA's reauthorization might come out, because they might be upset with the Taylor case going a certain way. And they go, yeah, we're going to change that 336 thing. They might take it out. They might also beef it up. You never know. So all these things are interconnected. And at some point, we don't really fully know when they're going to pop and come down the pike, but one going before the other has, it can affect the outcome.
107 implementation is going to basically clarify a lot of these things, because there's a lot of holes in the current. There's a 336 of the article that you read about no pilot license required for public service operation, except for the fact that in order to be go into restricted area, the FAA sent out the AC that says, okay, if you requested access, you one of the things you ask for is a pilot license. So you got a catch 22 going on there.
I mean, backing it up even with the 107, we don't even fully know what it's coming out as. We understand what they proposed it as, but the little birdies I'm talking to are seeming to indicate that stuff's getting added on, stuff's getting chopped up and pulled out potentially. So that, because remember, at the end of the day, it's proposed regulation. So I wouldn't completely bet on it. It's coming out as is, but it gives you a good silhouette, if you will, a shadow of what it looks like, probably. We don't know what the features of the, you know, what hair color, what the eyes are, you know, what shirt they're wearing, but we have a pretty good idea of the outline of what's coming down the pike. And I think people should know 107, read it, understand what's in there, what's not in there, and then find out how that matches up with their current business model. You know, they're doing FLIR stuff at night for, you know, they need to know that there's no hope for them under 107. They're going to have to fall back on the 333 to get night inspections done. And then within 500 feet of people, you know, is that going to be in there? Is that not going to be in there? So there's a lot of interesting questions. It's a shadow. Don't rely on it.
One thing that has been consistent, though, as the 107 came out, it mentioned online testing for operators. And the legislation that came after that, all the four of the current legislation that I'm aware of have brought that back in again. So it looks like that part of it is probably going to happen, is online testing, like the ground school FAA test.
Well, I think they actually took that out, and then in the ARC recommended it also, but I think the FAA is going to shoot that down, because at the end of the day, for the purpose of the TSA background check, they need to actually verify that person is who they are. That's the big problem with the whole drone registration setup, is that you can just jump online and register it using an alias and nobody would ever really know. And so there's no vetting that can really go on there. So under 107, you're most likely going to have a pilot's license you take. Then it's a computer-based exam that you go into a testing facility. And then once you print out the scores, you're going to mail those off to the FAA. And then you get back your pilot certificate sometime 7 to 10 weeks later in the mail after you've had your TSA background check already completed. So that's kind of what it's going to look like. And that mirrors how it's currently being done now with, as of April the 1st, that all just changed up with the student pilot certificate. That is what is going on right now, because you used to be able to just go quickly get your student pilot certificate rapidly, but now you actually have to send off the paperwork and then get it back in the mail before you can solo. So that's problematic. That's going to be the good proxy to see how 107 turns out with the timelines and how difficult and all that is, because that's what's happening right now, the pilot guys and stuff. So
one scenario that I heard was that take the written exam, you turn in your information for the TSA at the time you take the test, that goes through a process, and then one potential, it coming from a flight instructor, says, okay, then you'll show proficiency to an actual CFI like yourself. Would that fill that gap that you're talking about?
Potentially. I've heard some people talk briefly about that there needs to be some type of DPE or CFI that would do like a mini check ride kind of thing, and like a equivalent of like a BFR, biannual flight review for the manned pilots. And so there might be inclusion of that at some point, because we don't really fully know what's coming into the proposed regulations, but that might be in there.
Makes too much sense.
It makes sense. I think it makes a lot of sense, because there needs to be a gatekeeping function, at least, because you can pass a test. A test can't catch stupid. A flight instructor would be like, I ain't having your signature. I ain't having my signature in your logbook, buddy. Yeah, go to the next guy, you know? I see that happening. Like, they would weed those guys, those guys, in parentheses, they would weed them out.
Would that implementation of a test of any kind, regardless of the drawbacks to it, would that solve the problem of the cowboy operators?
Somewhat. I think that, coupled with heavy enforcement from the FAA and local law enforcement, I see that cracking down on a lot of the arrogant, rogue drone cowboy guys that are pretty prevalent right now. Because that is the stereotype. And I mean, the drone community is it's its own worst enemy. Like, they, like, you never, like, I mean, when do you ever see the drone community being like these very professional individuals that are walking around suit and tie? How can I help you? I'm out here to educate the community, blah, blah, blah. No, it's always some guy with Mr. Droopy Drawers with like a e-cigarette, a cigarette, and he's got his hat sideways and he's flying his Phantom doing real estate photography. That's the majority of like a lot of this drone market. Not the people also who come to these conventions, because you don't see that too often, because the people that are doing that are doing this like $50 an hour real estate stuff illegally or whatever, and so they're not coming to stuff like this because they think they know it all, because they've self-certified themselves as an expert. They're not coming here to learn anything. They won't. The FAA cracking down on that would actually be much more beneficial for the community as a whole, because that's what the community, I think, a lot of times sees, not responsible drone operators flying.
This might be a good juncture to point out the FAA's new program, the 1-800-CALL-FAA. Yeah, I think that's what
the tip line, yeah. And stuff. Yeah, I mean, yeah. So I could see that happening a lot. But then it seems like what it's used primarily now for is like a lot of the non-compliant guys are just ratting out all the other non-compliant guys, and it's just a bunch of rats on an island all just feeding off of each other. It's kind of what a lot of this was turning into right now.
It's 1-800-TEL-FAA. I just realized that was the real name.
Okay, so 1-800-TEL-FAA. Yeah. Then your competitors jump on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, grab the photos, then link it to the FAA, and then, yeah, that's when the investigation starts. By the time the investigation starts and you find out, it's already been going on, they've already gathered the info. It's kind of too late, at that point for you to take anything down, right? Because they already got it all and printed it out and saved it, so.
Or what I've run into lately is you go trying to sell to a real estate office and they say, we have our own. Are you authorized? No, we don't need to. We save money.
Well, they do that, but also at the same time, I mean, Skypan, the property management company that dealt with Skypan, they ended up having to deal with answering the subpoena that the FAA sent out. So there was time and money that were lost there in trying to actually just comply with the administrative order. And then in addition to that, if there's an accident, you could try to, personal injury attorney could try to sue the brokerage company under the idea of negligent hiring. It's like, yeah, he's a subcontractor. Yeah, but you had a duty to at least kind of screen him up front to make sure he's just not some psycho, and you're just unleashing him on everybody. And so, yeah, there's going to be an issue there whether they can even come back on the brokerages. So it just hiring an illegal operator could potentially cost you much more in the long run than what you think.
Or than anything you're going to save.
Right. You also come up with that shady kind of reputation. You're like, oh, those are those guys. They're like, drop the, whatever's the lowest price in town, we don't care. Wow, that seems to be a good tip off. And to, as well as the, if that's the culture of the broker, then, what else are they doing at the lowest buck to behind the scenes that you don't know? That'd be a quick discriminator for me. I'd be like, yeah, if you're doing that, I don't really want to deal with you. I'd rather deal with the guy that's a lot more expensive and above board on everything, because it's probably, a quick discriminator that he's probably above board on a lot of other areas too, as opposed to shady cutting corners.
I really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so much for talking to me.
All right. Well, we'd like to thank Tim for that interview. And also, of course, Jonathan always has some very interesting things to say about the industry. And as we mentioned, we'll bring more interviews from that event soon. I'm not sure how we'll do it, David. Might be a separate episode or maybe a special episode, but there's some interesting comments from many of the exhibitors at the show. Looking forward to that.
Yeah, and again, thanks, Tim, for covering for us. We got to get more of these shows up in the Northeast so, Max, so you and I can do it.
Yes.
They always seem to be in Louisiana or Texas or California on the other side of the world. So we're working on it, and I'm looking forward to, by the time this comes out, I will be halfway through my day at NASA, but that's all good for you guys because I'm going to have lots of good content, I'm sure.
Yeah. Now, David, did I see that you found us a video of the week?
I did. This was sent in from our Slack team, you know, and I'm no longer calling them Slackers, I know, but... Aurora Flight Scientists won their DARPA project and the Lightning Strike aircraft, which flew for the first time. And what's interesting is that is 24 ducted electric fans that caused the that causes the Lightning Strike to fly, all on battery power. So we've talked about this in previous episodes, and it's kind of interesting to see it fly. It's a very unique looking airplane with a lot of boxes, kind of like a Bristol box kite from the teens, as in 1900 and teen. So interesting video quickly. So I guess with that, should we tell people where they can find us?
Yes, we want to thank you, first of all, for listening to the UAV Digest. We really enjoy bringing this content to you. Hope you enjoy it. The feedback is always good. But we encourage all kinds of feedback so we can help improve the show. You've been listening to episode 143. As always, you can find us at theuavdigest.com. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, that, of course, is theuavdigest.com/143.
And you can be part of our communities, and we've got multiple. Like I mentioned earlier, our video of the week came from our Slack team. And that can be found at theuavdigest.com/team. And that will give you the directions to tell you a little bit about it. And it's a growing community. A lot of people talking. And we're trying to make a community that's specific towards UAVs. Or you can go to good old-fashioned Facebook, which is facebook.com/UAVdigest. Or don't forget, you can join us on Twitter and see our tweets at UAV Digest. If you want to write us or tell us how we're doing or submit a story that you want us to comment on, that's feedback@theuavdigest.com. And if you want to make us better, you can leave a review on iTunes at the UAV Digest or Stitcher.com. And last but not least, if you'd like to, like I will be using on Friday, have my postal bag that says the UAV Digest. I got it at our Cafe Press store. And you can become a patron of the show at patreon.com. And of course, all those links are available on the show notes. So with that, I'm going to say I look forward to talking to you next week. And this is David off to NASA.
And Max still in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.